Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's May 7th. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Good morning. 38 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City under some cloudy skies. Heber City is reporting 45 degrees under partly cloudy skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we're waking up to a little bit of mixed conditions out there. We've got some clouds still in the higher elevations there, banking up against the mountains. But as you come down a little lower in the elevation in the Heber Valley, we're seeing more of that sunshine. Temperatures starting off on a cool note, but not cold out there. Temperatures in the 30s and 40s, and we'll be seeing that sunshine breaking through as we go throughout the day. So more sunshine expected by this afternoon, and that should allow temperatures to warm up a little bit more than they have been the past couple of days. So in Park City, we're looking at high temperatures climbing to around the low 60s for highs today. In the Heber Valley, we're looking at those highs climbing close to 70 degrees. So overall, again, a little nicer out there for us with some slightly warmer temperatures expected across the area. Now, as we go into the second half of your work week, we've got more changes on the way as high pressure builds in. Today, we've got a high pressure at the surface building in. That's giving us clearing skies and more sunshine. But this next high pressure is going to be an upper level high pressure that's going to build in. And that's going to be basically what we call the heat dome during the summertime. This high pressure ridge builds in as we go into our Thursday and Friday. And that's going to lead to lots of sunshine, but also warming temperatures. So as we go throughout your Thursday, look for high temperatures to be into the mid to upper 60s for us in Park City, and high temperatures in the Heber Valley will climb into the mid 70s across the area. So some very nice conditions with mostly sunny skies. As we go into your Friday, look for those temperatures to start off around the 40 degree mark. As we get into your Friday afternoon, we're looking at highs to climb into the lower 70s for us. And then as you're looking into Heber Valley, we'll be seeing those highs climbing into the upper 70s, close to 80 degrees as we go throughout the afternoon hours. Beyond that, as we move into the weekend, even nicer, warmer conditions expected across the area, I should say, with temperatures climbing into the mid-70s in Park City for highs on Saturday with lots of sunshine. How about the lower 80s for the Heber Valley with that sunshine expected to be fairly predominant across the area? And as we go into your Sunday, we're looking at, we'll call it mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies, but still warm and breezy conditions. We'll see temperatures climbing into the mid 70s for highs in Park City and highs right around 80 degrees again in the Heber Valley. Now, I mentioned a few more of those clouds with the breezy conditions arriving by Sunday afternoon. That's ahead of our next storm system that's going to be approaching, and that system starts to move into the area on your Monday. We'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies. Highs will be around the 70 degree mark in Park City with highs in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. And then by Tuesday, we expect the heart of that trough to start to move in. That's going to be a dip in the jet stream, which means we've got some cooler, more unsettled weather conditions on the way. So Tuesday, we'll introduce a chance of scattered showers across both Park City and in the Heber Valley. And we'll see those highs dropping back into the low to mid 60s by then. But between now and then, Leslie, get ready for the heat because it's going to be on this weekend especially.
Okay. Thank you, Cedric.
Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Later on, the founder and executive director of the DePaul Cleft and Burn Center, Jim Weber, with details on the annual fundraiser. And finally, Park City Education President and CEO Ingrid Whitley, along with Jen Bello, Vice President of Advancement, with an update on Running with Ed. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include Jocelyn Scudder, Executive Director of the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County, discussing Park City's Art and Culture Master Plan, along with details about the upcoming Latino Arts Fest. Taking a look now at some local news, four of Summit County's mayors want to vote on a new slate of county council members immediately. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports they're asking state leaders to add the mandate to the new law this month.
House Bill 356 forces Summit County to draw five voting districts from which to elect its county council, which is currently elected at large. Lawmakers are expected to revise the bill during a special session soon after inadvertently roping Wasatch County into the same requirement to draw districts. HB 356 is also written to allow current council members to serve out the rest of their terms, but most of Summit County's mayors don't want to wait. A letter to Utah's House Speaker, Senate President, and Governor obtained by KPCW shows four of the six mayors want the bill changed into, quote, its strongest possible form. That means holding an immediate special election for all five Summit County Council seats. The letter KPCW obtained May 6th was signed by Mayor Kay Richens of Hennifer, Mark Marsh of Colville, Matt McCormick of Camas, and Jeremy Foreman of Francis. Zane Wolstenhume and Nan Worrell from Oakley and Park City, respectively, did not sign. The letter is dated April 14th, one day before the county held the first of two public comment sessions about HB 356. At the April 15th meeting, many of the mayors indicated they'd spoken with their constituents after the bill passed, and most of the residents who spoke at the meeting voiced support for five districts. Here's Matt McCormick.
And so from my perspective as mayor of Camas, I'm 100% in favor of the bill as it's currently written in every form. I want to be clear about it. In every form. I have a lot of people come into my office who live outside of my city limits. I'm sure all the mayors do.
Under HB 356, a committee of all the mayors and one unincorporated resident would work with the Summit County clerk to draw the five districts. County officials have complained that doesn't fairly represent unincorporated Summit County, where the majority of residents live. But Summit County's mayors assert that they can faithfully represent people who live near their towns, even if they didn't vote for them. Wolstenhume and Worrell supported putting an additional unincorporated resident on the districting commission, but the mayors didn't vote on the proposal.
I also agree, that said, that none of the mayors are going to try to do anything unfair about that. I think we are fair people.
The Oakley mayor said at a city council meeting last month he's in favor of districts for county council seats but disagrees with how HB 356 was passed, quote, basically without any hearings and input from the public. The letter signed by four of the other mayors accuses Summit County of being unfair, of making active efforts to circumvent the spirit and letter of this legislation. None of the mayors who signed the letter responded to KPCW's requests for comment Tuesday. From the perspective of the Summit County staff, County Manager Shane Scott told KPCW he was disappointed to read the letter and can only speculate about what's meant by the county trying to circumvent HB 356. He says he considers the county's relationship with the various cities constructive and collaborative, but says, quote, we were completely left in the dark. Speaking on KPCW's Local News Hour about how many unincorporated residents should sit on the districting commission, County Councilmember Canis Hart says some mayors don't want the council involved in boundary setting. McCormick of Camas has said HB 356 was not an appropriate topic of discussion for the Council of Governments, which consists of the six mayors and three members of the Summit County Council. He said it isn't a COG issue because the law only mentions the mayors. Here's Hart.
The reason when we're at the Council of Governments, you know, they push back and they're like, no, we really want this. They're mostly just afraid that the council is somehow going to water it down, that, you know, we'll dilute it or somehow make it play to our favor. It's kind of a trust thing.
Marsh and McCormick both said HB 356 is about geographic representation and not about Republican or Democrat. However, local Republicans said back in January that members of their party drafted the bill. Since it started meeting in 2009, the Summit County Council has always had one or two Eastern Summit County residents. They've been a mix of Republicans or Democrats, although currently all council members are Democrats. Municipal elected offices are nonpartisan. The special session of the Utah legislature, which has a supermajority of Republicans, is expected to happen later this month. Summit County's a financial supporter of KPCW, and I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Office, I have Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much. So we always like to start these interviews just getting a sense of any new applications, anything of significance come through the Planning Office.
Nothing dramatic, nothing for anyone to get excited about, I suppose, but that's my opinion. They're actually fairly low-key ones. The one that has had prior public interest and prior involvement, we have actually the final subdivision plat for the farms at Blue Sky. That's the 31-unit subdivision that got their preliminary approval at the Planning Commission a few weeks ago, and that will just be... It's really just an administrative process, go through, tick off them, goes to the manager. Did they meet all the rules and regulation? Then that will actually be approved unless they've actually failed to meet any of their obligations under that final plat. We have that one. Don't see any problems with it. Otherwise, just minor low-impact permits, a couple of condo plats, temporary use permit, nothing exciting. No big projects on the horizon.
Okay. And we wanted to get your take on how the... Town of Francis may change how it reviews developments. So I know you're aware of the hotel controversy there. Mm-hmm. Any opinion on how the best way to do conditional use permits?
I hesitate to offer an opinion on what any of the other jurisdictions should be doing. I'm more than happy to discuss what we do. The issue with a conditional use permit, which sometimes is a little less understood by members of the public, is that a conditional use permit in the state of Utah, it's essentially a use by right. It's already been approved. It's a permissible land use. The conditional use permit is what we call an administrative approval. So you're actually the planning commission or the council, whoever is acting as the administrative authority to approve the project, is actually just applying existing law. So, for example, in the Eastside General Plan, you know, or the Eastside Development Code, we have a land use table that classifies some uses as they're either just allowed by right, or just go get a building permit. They're what we call a low impact permit, which is a minor review of a type of conditional use permit, or you have a conditional use permit. The conditional use permit is, we accept the fact that that use is allowed in that zone. However, we recognize that there may be, because of the nature of the site, the location of the site, or the type of use, it may need extra consideration and review. So we run it through a screening exercise. We look at, are there any particular issues associated with this use, which again, it's allowed by the zone, but we recognize that there may be unique issues that perhaps need to be mitigated, impacts on the neighbor or the community at large. And those conditions are what the recommendation is given to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission actually finalizes those conditions. Those conditions have to be related to the particular use. It's not a way to bargain for something that otherwise wouldn't have been provided by a developer. It's to mitigate a reasonable condition to mitigate the potential impacts of the development. If that is achievable and those conditions are laid out, then the use will be approved. It's a use by right. There's no changes to code involved. The other decision that could be made would be a legislative decision. And those are typically made by the legislative body, which in our case is the county council. It'd be the municipal council, the town council in Francis's case. Sometimes the confusion arises where you have a recommendation by the planning commission and an administrative decision taken by a legislative body. We don't do that in the county. A lot of towns and jurisdictions do. It is possible for our county council to make an administrative decision, but it begins to get a little bit confusing because they step outside or perceived to step outside their boundaries and actually start to interpret code, make new code, make adjustments to zoning. Then that actually triggers it into a legislative process, which is a completely different type of process, different types of scrutiny. Conditional uses apply existing rules and regulations. Those rules and regulations tend to be written down, measurable standards. Members of the public who may come along and say, I don't like something, that's not a measurable standard. That actually is something that can be considered under a legislative decision, not under an administrative decision. I'm comfortable with the way we do it, which is to try and clearly separate administrative uses from legislative uses to avoid the confusion. We still get a lot of members of the public get very frustrated, and that's understandable. The best way to try and deal with that or head it off with any kind of complex application is to have the developer or even, you know, the authority, if it's appropriate, reach out to members of the public, make sure that the notices are well publicized, that input is gained from the public in advance so that everybody's very familiar with what they're looking at and what the limits and powers and duties are of the various approval authorities.
Okay. I want to move on to the, as part of that Cedar Crest development, the property owner, Larry H. Miller, says that it has let its application with Summit County expire. But isn't fact that the case? Has it expired?
It's It's a little bit more complicated than that. We actually had a meeting on a different matter with Representative Cedarcrest. Cedarcrest have specifically told us that their interest in the current village overlay zone, the 350 acres that they're annexing into Colville, they said they're not interested in following on with the application in the county. They are moving their entirety of their interest into Colville. Little bit of complication with that is that there are actually other landowners in the original village overlay zone application. We have had no discussion, involvement, or information from those landowners because, if you remember rightly, Larry H. Miller and Ivory Homes were actually spearheading that arrangement. But we're obliged to reach out to the other landowners and say we haven't had any contact. Easily by the end of this month, the project will have lapsed due to inaction. We're required to notify anybody. And we are also required to go back to council anyway. If the village overlay zone applicants want to continue, we need to go back to council and get a modification to the application as it stands. But technically speaking, We don't just ignore it. We will follow up. We will notify all the current landowners who haven't told us that they're not interested. Try and chase them down and said, are you going to be coming back with more information? Because if not, we might simply close the file.
I guess what happens with this? I mean, so much work was put into this development. Something I recall that was built from the ground up by the people living there. And now it feels like it's just any other development application. We've got a big developer trying to get probably as much density as possible. It's not going, it sounds like, provide what was originally intended for Cedarcrest, and that was to provide housing, affordable housing, for family members.
And if you remember during the conversation, Leslie, that was one of the stumbling blocks we had while the applicants were sitting in front of the Planning Commission was, How do we actually provide affordable housing? How do we guarantee some of this? That was part of the vision, create a town, a location, a village, if you may, for the actual locals first and foremost, and the existing residents and then the future residents. And how do we build upon that? So the vision remains. I believe the work we did is still of value. I think it's of great value. I think the local population, whether they're in Hoytsville or in Colville, everyone would be affected. Everybody who sits on Hoytsville Road who would be affected by whatever development takes place there benefited from the public engagement exercise that we went through, the vision that was described. The problem that we were having is that the Planning Commission were clearly saying, we need to know that we can get some benefit, affordable housing benefit, public benefit, those open spaces and civic plazas that everybody has an idea and a vision from. I don't believe either, Larry H. Miller or Ivory Homes were acting in bad faith. Their position was that we can't promise until we know what we're going to get. The scaling back, as far as they're concerned, probably makes it easier to determine what they're going to do, easier to determine how to phase and build a project. I'm carrying with myself the belief and hope and optimism that the work we did on our side of the county-city boundary line is of benefit and brings influence and benefit to Colville. So the citizens of Colville are informed. They know what they want. Larry H. Miller are bringing a land plan to Colville. If we have influenced that for the better, all well and good. The conversation was a valuable one. If Larry H. Miller describe a vision that the citizens of Colville say sounds great, my advice would be, okay, so how do they prove it? How do they guarantee it? And that's always a difficult exercise. That's the problem they had with our planning commission. It's probably going to be a similar exercise. How do you get past that suspicion? It's easy to say, yes, another developer bringing a big project for profit. Development in and of itself is not a bad thing. What we need to do is make sure that we actually get a recognizable, justifiable, beneficial partnership. We enhance the existing community and we don't cause unforeseen negative consequences. What we don't want is another large subdivision. Yeah. What we do want is a balanced mixed-use community for the benefit of everybody who uses it.
Let's move on to what's the latest with Dakota Pacific. Have they applied for their administrative development agreement to move forward with this?
I have no application on my desk, but I'm very aware of the fact that discussions are being held. Every now and again, I get a call asking for a clarifying question on what was meant on something else. So that, I believe that documentation is in process. I haven't seen it. I would like to say that by the time we have this conversation next month, then we'll actually have seen a document, and I'm actually fascinated to see what it is. I'm not aware of any dramatic changes, but the way the original agreement was written was very much that legislative document, the agreement being made with council, and converting that into an administrative version of the same thing. It takes a lot of work on behalf of more lawyers than developers scrolling through the language. If there are any surprises in it, I'm sure we'll all know very quickly.
Okay. The request for proposals for the Klein-Dolly property has closed. I think you received about a half dozen of them, and apparently this is going to county council later this month?
We have six applications. We were actually quite thrilled with the quality and the amount of information that was presented to us. I'm not going to go into any detail here before it goes to council. I wouldn't want to influence anybody inappropriately. But on the 21st of May, I believe, the council are going to be presented with each of those options and pass some of those opinions. Every one of them had pros and cons, good ideas in all of them. I don't know whether the council is going to say, hey, this is a great project, let's pick this one, or is there a way we can modify something one way or another. But we were actually very impressed with the amount of effort that people were willing to put into the process, and we want to make sure that their effort is recognized and justified.
All right, so none of them have been thrown out for just maybe not meeting the requirements of the RFP at this point?
No, I mean, some of them, maybe that doesn't thrill me as much as another one, but as I say, they all had something of interest. So there's something for everybody in it. Quite a wide variety, a mix, an interesting vision that different people had, and I'm sure there's something to appeal to everybody.
All right, construction of the Canyons parking garage underway. Will it be done in time for ski season?
Would I promise on somebody else's behalf? No, I won't. But interestingly, that does throw another interesting fact onto the table, because the big exciting construction projects going on are those two large projects at the Canyons. We've talked previously about the possible impacts of tariffs and economic instability on the potential impacts on the economy. Interestingly, both the affordable housing and the parking garage that came through as building permits in our department this year pushed our building figures and valuations for the first quarter of this year well past last year. So well past, seriously past. Well, like building valuations almost double what they were this time last year. Those two large projects we created some kind of cushion. They were held over a little bit at the end of last week. So those two big financial projects give us a little bit of a cushion. That's interesting and specific because, for example, we're going through some changes. We're hiring a couple of new planners. The building department's going through a big change. The chief building official's retiring next week after 33 years. We're going to be training new staff into place. So hopefully, if we see a little bit of a tail off and uncertainty in the economy, it won't be a dramatic crash as far as we're concerned. And maybe this will actually give us the confidence for people to move forward. So if the Canyons parking garage moves forward faster rather than more slowly, I have no qualms with that. If we can have a serious parking solution by next ski season, we'll all be very happy.
So put some numbers to that. When you talk about twice as much as the value of permit authorized construction there, what was it for the first quarter?
Well, I know that, for example, building permit valuation, I have actually a spreadsheet, if you can be patient with me for 1 second, I'll pull that number up. But the I'm toying with the idea of $100 million, probably $40 million in excess of last year.
Wow. Okay. Well, we can follow up with you.
I'll tell you exactly. The first quarter building valuations, $106 million. $49 million ahead of last year, 89% ahead.
Wow. Impressive. Okay. And as you mentioned quickly, that the chief building official, Richard Butts, is retiring. My guess is that, what, he just kind of worked his way up the ladder?
He did. He started at the lower levels of construction, exploring the mysteries of the construction world, joined as a junior planner 31 years ago. The younger staff amongst us are, you know, weren't even born when Richard was inspecting buildings in Summit County. The county actually owes a debt of gratitude to a man who's dedicated his entire life to health and safety of the citizens of Summit County. So we're delighted for him and despairing for ourselves, but we've got a great team in place and very happy for him and hope he enjoys a fabulous retirement.
Okay, Peter, anything else you wanted to mention?
That's enough for me, Leslie. If you have any questions, any of your listeners have any questions, feel free to get in touch. I'll see if I can answer them as best I can.
Okay. Peter Barnes is the Summit County Community Development Director. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center opened more than 10 years ago in Kathmandu, Nepal. It was founded by Park City resident and owner of Foothill Oriental Rugs, a supporter of KPCW, Jim Weber, a longtime underwriter on KPCW. He joins me now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Always like just to get an idea, I mean, of how this nonprofit organization came to be.
It came to be because I'm in the Oriental Rug business, and I ended up being part owner of a rug factory, a carpet factory in Kathmandu, Nepal, with some Tibetan refugees that I met when I was there. And we formed a wholesale company called Tibet Rug Company, and we design and market the rugs on this side of the world, and my Tibetan partners manufacture the rugs on that side of the world. So after so many years spending time in Nepal, it became my spiritual home. And if ever a country needed help, it's Nepal. Tiny country in between two regional superpowers, and they need all the help they can get. And so I thought about it for a couple of years and decided I would do something either educational or delivering medical services. And I ended up connecting with an amazing humanitarian physician in Kathmandu. And it just became a no-brainer. I was going to support him and build him a clinic to operate out of, because he didn't even have a clinic to operate out of. And so in 2002, I started the nonprofit. And in the next 6 years, I tried to drum up support in the rug industry to help me support it. And the idea is we were going to build him a clinic to operate out of. And the clinic morphed into a 16,000 square foot, four-story hospital that opened its doors in 2014, and it's called the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center.
Now, the center serves those both born with cleft palates as well as burn victims. It just seems like such an odd combination, but is that because both require plastic surgery?
Well, we started out because Nepal didn't have a teaching hospital to teach Nepali surgeons to do cleft lip and palate procedures. And they have a high incidence of cleft lip and palate births in Nepal.
Is that, what, genetic?
They think it might be genetic, or they think it might be prenatal nutritional issues, which makes sense to me. But Nepal is one of the, and they measure the cases by the number of cases per 1,000 births. And Nepal is one of the countries that has a high incidence of cleft lip and palate births. So some other, they're all third world countries, Vietnam, Peru, India, Nepal. So before we opened the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center, the country of Nepal depended on great organizations like Operation Smile and Doctors Without Borders. They would come in for a week-long camp once a year. And once again, a great great organizations, but it doesn't fill the void, and they're not there for follow-up procedures. They're not there for speech therapy. They're not there for all sorts of required follow-up procedures. So our hospital is a continuous, ongoing part of the medical infrastructure of Nepal. And we have met the need for cleft lip and palates. Now, burns is a whole different story. Burns, people in countries like the U.S. don't understand the scope of burns in third world countries. First of all, Nepal has 30 million people crammed into a tiny space two-thirds the size of the state of Utah, with a population almost of Canada. Combined with rampant poverty and a high rate of illiteracy, and they have a lot of children. So, and more than half of this 30 million population cooks over open fires. So it's just a bad combination. And burns are a huge problem in countries like Nepal. And we really, when we opened the center, didn't understand the scope of the burn problem, but it's huge. We can't meet demand. And it is associated with cleft lip and palate surgery, interestingly enough, because it requires a skilled plastic surgeon. So that's really the bulk of our work are burns. And with cleft lips and palates, we can change a kid's life. We can turn a kid's life around for average cost of a $300 procedure. With burns, we not only change lives, we save lives.
Yeah. What kind of numbers do you see at the clinic?
We've done, the first year we opened, I think we did 200 burns. And last year we did around 2,000 burn treatments. It's a huge problem, and it's a problem created partially by our success. We've become, over the years, the number one burn treatment center in the country. In fact, the government refers to the Nepal Clifton Burn Center now as the National Burn Center. In other words, if you have a life-threatening burn, your chances of survival are higher at the Nepal Clifton Burn Center than any facility in the country. And that's really an ironic situation, because we opened this facility to serve the poor of Nepal, and that's what we do, and we still do that to this day. But we've also become the center of excellence for burn treatment.
So is the Nepalese government helping to support you financially?
Well, what happened is when we brought this hospital up out of the ground back in between 2010 and 2014, the Nepalese government saw the need for our center, and they stepped in and helped us build it. We started it. We brought it up out of the ground. Now, Leslie, we've started our second hospital in southeastern Nepal, because this is the area where we get the majority of our out of Kathmandu area cases, and it's the second highly most densely populated area of Nepal. So we broke ground on a second Nepal Cleft and Burn Center, and once again, we're going to bring it up out of the ground, and we're really anticipating the government will step in and help us once they see what we're going to do for that region of Nepal.
Yeah, so how's that project going? I mean, do you hope it open this year, or does it take longer than that?
I learned with the first project that working in third world countries, you've got to be patient. So we're patient, but we're persistent. We're actually going to put the footings in the next month. In fact, our goal was to have some tangible evidence to show our supporters for our upcoming fundraiser, which is a week from this Friday in Salt Lake.
Okay, well, tell us about the fundraiser.
We do the fundraiser every year, and we're really just a little grassroots organization, and the fundraiser is our main source of income every year, and it's also how the public kind of sees that we're pushing this project forward. So over the years, it's evolved into a really wonderful event. It started out 12 years ago in my rug store down at, and people would sit around on stacks of rugs. We didn't even have tables for people to sit at, and it's evolved over the years, and last year we did it in the Natural History Museum, which I think might be the finest piece of architecture in the state of Utah, and it's right by Red Butte Gardens near the University of Utah, and everyone loved it, and it was a great venue to work out of and spectacular for everyone who attended, so we decided to do it there again, and that's where it is this year.
Okay, so give us an idea of how the evening goes.
It starts out with the cocktail hour, and we're hoping for good weather where we can utilize that beautiful patio out on to the west of the museum overlooking the Salt Lake Valley. it once again has evolved into an amazing event. We have live music, a great band, great food, dinner, open bar, dancing, and we have and our main physician from Nepal is flying in to do a presentation. I always do a presentation. We have a live and silent auction. It starts at 6 p.m. and ends at 10 p.m. and it really is a fun event.
All right, tickets are how much?
Tickets are $135. It includes dinner and an open bar. Like I said, I always tell people, you know, come. If you don't have fun, I'll give you your money back. Money back guarantee. It really is a fun event.
Yeah, and where do people purchase tickets?
People can go online, www.NepalCleftAndBurnCenter.org, and they can register online. They can call my rug store, Foothill Oriental Rugs, 801-582-3500. We'll get them registered. And particularly for Park City residents, we have a bus that leaves out of Kimball Junction that will take you down and bring you back for free. So no reason not to come.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you just a little bit. I got a couple minutes. Just about rugs themselves. I mean, these are something that people will buy. I mean, they last a lifetime. How have you stayed in business so long? It's like people always need a new rug.
Well, I think that I opened my store in '85, and I've been in business since then. And I think my key to success is that I'm actually a direct importer. That's how I ended up opening the Nepal Cleft and Burn Centers, because I do business on that side of the world. And very few retailers in the country are direct importers. Most retailers buy from wholesalers, which is what Tibet Rug Company is, and we sell to dealers around the country. So that's really been my key to success. That, and I'm part of the community. I'm from here, I live here, and I think that's been the key to my success. But yeah, rugs are a beautiful form of art, functional art. I call it textile art.
Yeah, and they're all made with wool?
Mostly they're hand knotted, and since they're hand knotted, they're very labor intensive. So there's no point not using the best material possible to make them, because it just adds incremental cost to produce the product. So yes, there's no reason not to use wool. So most of our rugs are made out of wool.
Yeah, and all importers are kind of facing this whole reality of tariffs. What do tariffs in Nepal mean for you?
It's really sent shockwaves through my industry, like a lot of industries. We're just hoping that the government's work things out, because if we have to add a 35% tariff to our product, it's gonna either raise our prices significantly or we'll have no profit. So we're just hoping the government's work things out.
Yeah, so that's the 35%, that's the tariff.
That's what it is right now out of India. Nepal is 10%, but even 10% on this product, it really adds significantly to our cost. I just put in a huge order to people I do business with in Afghanistan. They do beautiful vegetable dyed rugs in Afghanistan. And these tariffs, if the tariffs aren't resolved by the time my rugs come off the loom, which will be about a year from now, I'm not sure what I'm going to do in terms of bringing. I mean, I'm going to bring them in. I have to, because I've committed to them. But boy, it will, like I said, it will either add to my retail price or suck all my profit out.
Yeah. What is the situation in Afghanistan? I mean, can you go there?
You can go there. I don't go there because I haven't been. I've been there, but I go to the villages on the Afghan-Pakistan border in the northwest frontier province. It's really just like being in Afghanistan. And frankly, all the rugs that have come out of Afghanistan since for the past 20 years come through Pakistan, because the rug finishing industry in Afghanistan has just doesn't exist anymore. They're trying to build that infrastructure up, but right now the best finishing for that product in that part of the world is in Lahore, Pakistan. So the rugs are actually produced in Afghanistan, smuggled over the border, finished in Pakistan, and that's where I export them out of.
Interesting. All right. Do you have anything else you want to mention?
No, just Nepal Cleft and Burn Center is an amazing little grassroots organization based right here in Salt Lake City. And the thing that I say all that I'm proud of about it is that 95% of the money we raise, you never hear that number, 95% of the money we raise goes to the project, because we basically operate on next to zero budget.
All right, Jim, always good to see you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Jim Weber, again, is the owner of Foothill Oriental Rugs in Salt Lake City, a longtime supporter of KPCW, also executive director of the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center in Nepal. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The signs are out around town, marking the route of this year's Running with Ed. In the studio now with an update from Park City Education Foundation, I have CEO Ingrid Whitley, along with Vice President of Advancement, Jen Bello. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning.
I saw that you had extended early bird registration. Is that still available or is that shut down?
It is. We extended the regular registration through Friday. So it will go up to $200 on Saturday. So get your registration now.
Yeah. What are you seeing in registrations? Are the same numbers that you've seen in the past? Or?
Yeah, so numbers are similar. We're a teeny bit behind, which is why we extended the deadline a little bit. I think Park City is definitely a last-minute town in a lot of ways. And so we just wanted to be sure to give as many people as possible the chance to get that regular registration, because we know $200 is a big ask. But by the time it gets to be the week before the race, it's a lot to do to add people in. So we're really encouraging people to get that registration in. This year's swag bag is worth about $170, the swag you get. So you're actually getting more than what your registration cost is. And that includes an awesome t-shirt. Also this year, if you fundraise $500, you get $100 of your registration back. So we're really trying to make it as affordable as possible. And of course, we scholarship all the teachers, thanks to Christie's, and any student on free and reduced lunch.
All right. How much are you hoping to raise out of this?
So the goal is $325,000. That's the same as the last couple of years. And Running with Ed funds our classroom grants and express grants for the next year. And so we budget that around between $250,000 and $300,000. So Running with Ed is a critical fundraiser for Park City Education Foundation to fund those grants that go directly into teacher classrooms.
Okay. People, you've got your own website. People just go runningwithed.com.
Yeah, runningwithed.com. And the other thing I will say is it's fun, right? Like, it is a super fun day. We hear at the end of the day, oh my gosh, I was so busy. It's Maycember. I was, you know, bringing kids here and there. But in between, I ran a leg, and then I stopped at the field house, you know, to grab some food and beverage. And it's just such a fun day. We've heard people say, this is like one of the last really local days where I feel like it's all locals running. It's teachers, it's neighbors, it's Olympians. And so sometimes people are like, oh, running, you know, my knee, my ankle, my ACL, we're all Park City injured, right? But there are legs that are a mile. There is a leg from McPullen to Treasure Mountain, which are right next door to each other, and you walk on Dozier Field. So I just encourage everyone, you will not regret running and Running with Ed.
Yeah, what is the longest leg?
The longest leg is 5.7 miles. And that is from Treasure to Trailside, but you run through Round Valley, so it's beautiful. It's really, really gorgeous. There's also the leg, if you are a diehard, of running up to the UOP and running up the 700 and some steps. That is a doozy of a leg, but you can take the chairlift if you'd prefer.
Okay, and you can walk.
Yeah, and you can walk, 100%. We have a lot of walkers, actually. The leg between Jeremy Ranch and Ecker is 1.2 miles. A lot of people walk that. A lot of people walk the McPullen to Treasure. And then Trailside to the field house, which is the last leg, is the same as a 5K. And a lot of people will just do that one as well. And then we have this super fun finish party at the end, you know, with food and beverage, tons of sponsor giveaways, music. We award the Park City Mountain Grant to the schools with the highest participation. We have awards for best costume, best exchange. And there's no speed prizes because we don't really care.
Okay. All right, Ingrid, as Jen mentioned, the money from Running With Ed goes towards the express grants and the classroom grants. So what's the process for funding those?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a classroom grants committee, and it's made up of mostly educators, students. This year, I think we had just one parent. And we actually met last week, right? Mm-hmm. Had about a four-hour meeting and deliberated about all of the applications we received from educators. Really fun process.
So those are grants that are be used with this year's money or from last year? I mean, a year later?
Yeah, so we're selecting the grants that will go into effect next year, so next school year. Exactly, yep.
Using this year's Running with Ed
funding. Yes, exactly, yep. Okay. And so we created this intentionally as a participatory grant making committee. We want to have the people most impacted by the grants at the table making the decisions. And it was really fascinating this year to hear the students were particularly active in the discussion, which I loved. And it made us make different decisions than we would have otherwise, not having their voices at the table.
All right. And then those express grants, those are done immediately. They don't need to go through this committee?
Nope, though it doesn't go through the committee. We do have a review process internally with our team, and those are kind of emergent one-off needs that teachers come up with, you know, throughout the year up to $1,000 this year. We're raising that limit, I believe, next year, more to come there. But we're, you know, excited to continue offering that support as, again, emergent needs arise throughout the year.
Okay, so the final say is the Park City Education Foundation Board, not the Park City Board of Education.
Yes, exactly. So our board, Park City Education Foundation's board, will approve the recommendations from the committee at our next meeting on May 22nd, and then we'll share the award winners at the end of May. And again, those awards go into effect next school year.
Okay. Let's see. We also recently reported on those Excellent Educators Awards. What else did you want to say about that?
Yeah, we're just, again, really grateful to the Lewis and Doyleney families for their ongoing support. This is a program that's been 29 years, almost 30 years, which is incredible. It's a very longstanding program in our community, and we're just really grateful to play a role in honoring all of the educators. This year, we had Susan Boone from Jeremy Ranch, Joanna Hamill from McPullen, Amy Bean from Parley's Park, Sam Johnson from Trailside, Andrea Solom from Ecker, Sharon Maddox from Treasure Mountain, and Joanna Andres from Park City High School, who won both the Excellent Educator and Stephen and Sarah Doyleney Award, which is voted on by the senior class as the teacher who has been most influential in their high school, or not high school, their K through 12 career. And so she was the first ever to win both awards at the same time.
Wow, that's significant. And again, people who vote for that, Are they just the seniors that make that decision?
Yeah, the Sarah and Stephen Doyleney Award is just the senior class voting, you know, on who they think is the most influential teacher in their career at through Park City School District. Teachers vote for the Excellent Educator Award, so teachers within their own school. Yeah.
Do we get others besides high school teachers? I mean, do we see some of that go down into the elementary and middle school grades?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's my favorite because there's always a kindergarten teacher who gets a nomination. This year, I think there was a teacher from Ecker. There were teachers who are no longer teaching. We send out every comment, so we really encourage the teachers and the students to make a comment on their form. And it's all anonymous, and you're typed in a Google form, so you can't even tell whose handwriting it is. But we send those all out on Excellent Educator Days. So 165 teachers received a comment in the district, and that's pretty remarkable. And so we send those out, and I would say every year there's at least five that aren't from the high school. And there was one teacher, he works for the county now, and I found his email and sent it to him. And he said, oh, thank you. This is so meaningful. Mm-hmm. You know, he switched careers, but it was really nice to know that he impacted someone's life enough that they nominated him for the Sarah and Stephen.
And I just also want to acknowledge it's Teacher Appreciation Week. So thank you to every teacher in Park City School District and across Summit County for all the work you do in our schools.
Okay. Hey, I wanted just to get your input on this. I'm hearing that there's going to be some changes to the Bright Futures program. This is one of the programs, mm-hmm. the seven programs that you run as the Ed Foundation. We just saw a handful of these college graduates graduate.
Yes.
So what's happening with the program?
Yeah, we celebrated 11 college graduates this year from the class of 2025. Yeah, we went through a strategic planning process with our board of directors this year and evaluated, you know, everything that we've been working on for the last 5 or 6 years. Bright Futures is one of those programs. And we have a core value of equity and inclusion. And one of the things that we discussed was not every first-gen student is getting support currently from the way the program is structured. And so next year, we're going to be funding a position in the high school who will be working with every first-gen student, starting in ninth grade all the way through senior year.
Okay. And, well, who are you working with now? Just some?
No,
first-gen
exactly. Yeah, so it's an opt-in structure, so not every first-gen student in the high school gets the coaching and support that we're providing currently. And so we thought we should be expanding the support we're offering.
All right. So is it just going to be a high school program, or are you going to take them through college graduation now?
Continuing the college part exactly the same way. So we have a staff member on our team who will continue coaching and providing financial support to all the college students. But we're excited to have, the high school students have expanded support every single first-gen kid next year.
All right. So that's why you're changing it, because you think it's going to be a bigger program?
Exactly. Yeah, so we're excited to be able to create some efficiencies, just working better with the school district, partnering with them on things that they're already offering. And that enables us to be more creative with how, again, we're leaning in with support from a financial perspective.
Okay. Anything else?
No, we're very excited about that next year, where instead of kind of an after-school program, that service maybe 60 kids, will be able to almost triple that with an in-school first-generation specific counselor. So, but that has to be funded, and so that's, other fundraisers, but with Running With Ed, if we don't have to pull from classroom grant funding to fund that, we can do that if everyone supports Running With Ed. So the other thing is, not only registration, we need volunteers. That's at runningwithed.com. You can come just to Fieldhouse for $30 for your family. It's all on runningwithed.com.
Okay. Hey, Jen, Bello, and Ingrid Whitley, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.